It please the court, Malin Martin, I represent Ryerson, Inc. This is a matter that involves insurance coverage for a claims related to a stock purchase agreement. A predecessor of Ryerson sold a group of companies to another company called EMC. It included a holding company and two operational companies. After the sale to EMC, EMC sued Ryerson and alleged multiple theories, including both a theory of fraud and an attempt to rescind and undo the transaction, as well as other non-fraud type claims, breach of warranty claims, breach of contract type claims. Breach of warranty is a type of claim that's precisely covered by the federal policy. The policy covers wrongful acts, including any omission, any misleading statement, on and on. At the time that the suit was filed, Ryerson's broker promptly placed Federal on notice of the suit and provided the suit papers to Federal. So Federal had those initial pleadings at the very outset. Months later, Federal issued a denial letter. In that letter, it told Ryerson there is no coverage because it does not meet the definition of a securities transaction. That was the basis for repudiating the contract and not honoring the contract. That took Ryerson aback to be told that a stock sale, stock purchase agreement, was not a securities transaction, as the denial certainly was something that was put Ryerson in disbelief. And although there's some suggestion in the briefs from Federal that there was a denial and some lengthy silence, the court can rest assured the brokers and others after this, there was a tremendous amount of communication as to that securities transaction denial, that it wasn't a securities transaction, yet Federal stood on that denial.
Why isn't it within the exclusion for profit or advantage to which the insured wasn't legally entitled?
Because in this case, and drawing on this court's Level 3 opinion, the bottom line of Level 3 and improper advantage is the notion that somebody has taken something wrongfully. The language used in the case is that something is stolen, essentially, and returned. This is not what is at issue here. In the instance, and we all can agree that stealing is bad and stealing ought not to be condoned.
I understand. Having gained, in fact, any profit, so Ryerson or its predecessor, by its fraud or whatever you want to call the precise wrong, it got a profit to which it wasn't legally entitled, and then it returned it. So why isn't it squarely within the language of the...
Because that assumes that Ryerson was guilty of not having been legally entitled to it when that wasn't the case. Ryerson certainly believed it was legally entitled to it. A breach of warranty doesn't mean that you're not legally entitled to the amounts.
I don't understand you. It doesn't say anything about what the insured thinks. Let me ask you another question. The way in which the settlement with EMC was described by the parties was as a price adjustment. You know, Ryerson had sold these companies for more than they were worth, so the price adjustment, in effect, lowered the price that they had charged. Why isn't that a perfectly good description of what happened? They overpriced wrongfully. So they return the excess, and that's a price adjustment in the contract price.
Well, that's not the way it actually unfolded.
I don't understand that. That's what they said. I don't know about the unfolding. That's the bottom line. They overpriced because they, you know, concealed information from the buyer. They're caught. They're sued. So they settle by adjusting the price, so they're returning, in effect, their ill-gotten gain, which is what, you know, this exclusion seems to be describing.
Well, Your Honor, when you have a sales transaction, and I don't think there's anything wrong. I'd like to start first by saying when parties contract, they contract to obtain a gain. They obtain to
Yes, I know, benefit. But there are things that you're not allowed to do to obtain. Now, so, for example, if you sell... If you sell something which you think really isn't worth as much as the buyer thinks it is, that's fine. But if and that's actually very important. But if if the buyer, you know, asks you a question, is this really a diamond? And you know it's actually a piece of glass, and you say, oh, yeah, this is a diamond, all right. You know, that's fraud. And so the price you get for the diamond, which is actually just a piece of glass, the profit you make on it, that's an ill-gotten gain, right?
That's assuming.
Why is that any different from this case?
But that's assuming the party is guilty from the outset and the allegations are true.
I don't understand assuming outset anything like that. They settled the case, and
if you look at the trial court's opinion on the dispositive motions, the trial court was taking EMC as much to task.
Why do you think Ryerson did it? Because it thought it could settle a meritless case because the insurance company would pay? That can't be right.
Well, I think
that's what you're saying. It settled a meritless case, and knowing that the insurance company would be on the hook for it.
The reason that a party would ordinarily settle a case is this had dragged on for years in litigation. They're already seven figures, and they weren't being reimbursed by federal. They're already in the seven figures and paying out. They weren't even at trial yet. You're looking at a trial, possible appeals, remands, and an ongoing disruption to its business. Yesterday I was here where Your Honor was talking about the restructuring that was taking place in the steel industry. That was all going on at this point in time. Ryerson was going through heavy competition, restructuring, being sidetracked in a significant piece of litigation for which it wasn't.
Look, I don't understand how that can be a basis for insurance, right? I mean, I can't get away from this language. It seems just very clear. I don't get it. You're saying that somehow they're entitled to insurance unless the insurance company proves that they settled because of guilt rather than because of future expenses or disruption? Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. But parties settle for a variety of reasons, and we can go over the variety of reasons. And I've sat in chambers with judges who have talked parties who are very convicted about their position, but why there are benefits to settling, and they may not, you know, they ordinarily aren't because.
What? Give me a case where this exclusion would apply.
Well, certainly if a party went, and as in level three, the only claim, the sole basis of recovery is saying this was stolen from us, we want to have it unwound, we want to be having our money returned to us. And that's the basis of proceeding. That provision would apply then.
How is that different from this case?
Because in this case, there are other. Under that case, you have a clear and convincing type standard. The party is put to the test for establishing fraud. There's a difference between stealing, which is fraud, and a commercial dispute over a breach of warranty. In breach of warranty, it's a preponderance of the evidence type issue. This one could go either way. And in that instance, Ryerson, had it gone to trial and prevailed, would have had rightful gain, proper gain.
What does that have to do with the language of this exclusion, which says was not legally entitled? It could be not legally entitled because it was a breach of warranty or for a million other reasons.
Legally entitled.
You're injecting a qualification into this exclusion, which would be very clumsy to litigate, very complicated, and which doesn't appear anywhere in the policy.
Not legally entitled would have to establish that it was wrongful in the sense of something that was done improperly.
Like a violating a warranty.
That's a breach of contract. That's not that's, I think that's quite different from the notion of something that's wrongfully obtained in the sense of level three, a wrongful taking. The very position that Federal is taking here today was taken only after the case proceeded, only after the litigation was ongoing, only after a settlement was received, and only after Ryerson pursued coverage litigation and was for the first time raised in the course of coverage litigation. Federal had in its hand from the outset the very pleadings on which it is now basing and constructing the argument it is raising now. The very provision that Your Honor is referring to was not raised at the outset, and Federal denied on the basis that it was not a securities transaction. This Court also views that there's something fundamentally wrong about a party repudiating a contract, saying it's on the basis of this not being a securities transaction, And then years later, when it's in coverage litigation, completely switching fields, going to a completely and dramatically different grounds and raising arguments and rationales for repudiating the contract that didn't exist before. It's the very basis of the court mend the whole doctrine. That's improper. It violates the notion of good faith in contracting. If you're going to repudiate, state your basis for repudiation and proceed from there. Don't change fields years later and start to throw up every possible hurdle that you can imagine. Going back to the notion, obviously, to the extent that Ryerson also was of the position, we talk about contracts. Everyone enters into a contract seeking to obtain a gain or a benefit. No one goes into a contract anticipating losing out. Ideally, in contracts, it's a win-win situation. Everybody wins, but that doesn't always happen. And in some contracts, and it's not all that unusual, one party may be unhappy, one party may be happy. In this case, EMC did not disaffirm the contract. It did not pursue the notion that it is in level three, that it was a fraud and the money is going to be returned to EMC. We're going to unwind the transaction and put us back to where we were before. Instead, what EMC did was it affirmed the contract. And one of the things you can't do is cherry pick. You either affirm the contract and decide to, if you believe that there's some damages that are going to result from it, to sue on those damages, or if you believe you're defrauded and you're hoodwinked, as is described in Level 3, then you try to unwind the transaction and put yourself back to where you were before. In this instance, EMC dropped those kinds of claims, the rescission, return of money, wrongfully obtained type claims, and proceeded to go forward on contract breach of warranty types claims, affirmed the contract. They wanted Brockway Metals. It kept Brockway Metals. It cherry-picked what it wanted out of the contract. And then proceeded to try to pursue Ryerson for damages on the portions it didn't like. When you're involved in a contract, I don't think, you know, when you're in the situation that was in level three, you don't get to cherry pick what you like or don't like. If you want to disaffirm the contract and say that you're a hoodwink, then proceed on that and under that standard and seek to have the money returned to you. If you affirm the contract and you believe that there's portions you don't like and you have arguments or positions that may allow you to seek damages as a result of it, that's what we have here, and that's what that is what EMC proceeded to do. It kept the contract in place. It proceeded under the contract, and then proceeded in the litigation under those kinds of theories. Dropped all equitable claims. Removed the case from Chancery over to Law Division, and it was in that context, after years of litigation, after seven figures in defense costs, which Federal was not reimbursing, and facing years more of litigation, that Ryerson settled the case. As I had said previously, Ryerson proceeding and winning, that's gain and that's benefit that Ryerson's entitled to. That was never resolved as to whether or not Ryerson was entitled to it or not. That gain that Ryerson would have obtained, it would be entitled to receive. There was obviously a dispute. The policy covers wrongful acts. And those wrongful acts are things like omissions, are things like misleading statements. Not all misleading statements and not all omissions are fraudulent, and they don't rise to the level of stealing, which is what Level 3 was all about.
You're in there, your rebuttal time. You know that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Bauer?
May it please the court, counsel, Eileen King Bauer on behalf of Appalee Federal Insurance Company. The district court's order granting summary judgment in favor of Federal must be upheld on appeal because the district court was clearly right in finding that Level 3 controls the outcome of this case. Level 3, issued by this court, is often cited as the seminal case standing for the proposition that a claim for restitution of ill-gotten gains is not covered loss within the meaning of an insurance policy. This court said, framed the issue as follows in Level 3. How a claim or judgment order or settlement is worded is irrelevant. An insured incurs no loss within the meaning of the insurance contract by being compelled to return property that it had stolen, even if a more polite word than stolen is used to characterize the claim for the property's return.
Martin says that that here all there was a breach of warranty, and that's just a breach of contract. And when the policy talks about a profit or advantage to which the insured was not legally entitled, it means something stronger than a breach of contract.
Well, I disagree with that statement. The label put on the claim, whether it's fraud in the inducement, breach of contract, breach of warranty, really is not dispositive. The question is, what is the nature of the relief requested? And in this case, there's no doubt that the nature of the relief requested was restitutionary. In the underlying claim, the plaintiff, EMC, alleged that Ryerson, the policyholder here, fraudulently induced EMC into entering into a stock purchase agreement.
So there's a fraud allegation, not just breach of warranty.
There were three claims, Your Honor: fraud in the inducement, breach of contract, and breach of warranty. And importantly, when the underlying case was transferred from the Chancery Division of the Circuit Court of Cook County to the Law Division of the Circuit Court of Cook County.
Right. Sorry.
The underlying case was transferred from the Chancery Division of the Circuit Court of Cook County, where it was filed because initially EMC sought rescission of the stock purchase agreement. But EMC, during the pendency of the underlying suit, sold the subsidiary at issue and then could no longer obtain rescission, but moved to transfer the case to the Law Division. But the operative pleading never changed. The record reflects that the operative pleading was always the first amended complaint. And the first amended complaint always included fraud in the inducement, breach of contract, and breach of warranty. But the theory that the plaintiffs were pursuing, the relief the plaintiffs were requesting, was the restitution of an ill-gotten gain. The plaintiffs wanted to get back from Ryerson the amount of money that Ryerson wrongfully obtained by, at least from EMC's perspective, fraudulently inducing EMC into paying more for a company that it should have paid. And everything in the record reflects that when the parties settled the underlying claim, what they did was change the price that was paid for the company initially. It was a post-closing price adjustment. That is what the settlement agreement says, and there's nothing in the record that would contradict that statement. There's nothing in the record, for instance, from Ryerson that would demonstrate that the fraud claim was baseless. And as this court noted in Level 3, in a very similar situation, there was no evidence in the record there to indicate that the underlying fraud claim was baseless. So what else would the parties have resolved? What else would they have paid for? This was clearly a claim that was restitutionary in nature. EMC sought and ultimately obtained from Ryerson the difference between the value and the price of the stock at the time the transaction took place and the value of the stock at the time of the settlement. If Your Honors have no further questions on the loss issue, I'd like to move on to the second argument raised by Ryerson, which is the mend the hold issue. Ryerson contends that even if it has failed to meet its burden of proving that the underlying claim is one for covered loss, that Federal is somehow estopped from relying on that, and that estoppel would allow it to create coverage. Well, the mend the hold doctrine is a highly unique type of estoppel. It only applies in situations where parties in litigation or parties in a dispute change their position, and when the party changes its position, it prejudices the other party. Illinois case law is very clear that estoppel cannot create coverage. And in this instance, if Ryerson's argument was successful, that's exactly what would happen. Here, Ryerson has the burden of proving that the claim falls initially within the coverage of the policy. Here, Ryerson must come forward with evidence to show that the claim involves a covered loss within the scope of the policy. It has failed to do so. It can't now, aha, turn around and say, because in 1999, loss was not identified as an issue in the response to the the claim that somehow coverage is created. The estoppel, creating coverage by estoppel theory clearly applies here. Ryerson cannot do that in this instance. And finally, I believe for the first time on appeal, Ryerson raised a waiver argument that may be perhaps because it has never been able to demonstrate prejudice, which it would have to show in order for estoppel to apply. But waiver clearly does not apply in this situation. Waiver is a relinquishment of a known right, and there's simply no evidence in the record to support an argument that Federal in any way, shape, or form waived the right to raise the loss issue. If Your Honors have no further questions, I would just ask that this Court affirm the order of the District Court in favor of Federal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Mr. Martin, how much time does he have?
1 minute. Very briefly, Your Honors, one of the issues that was raised by opposing counsel was that there was no evidence that contradicted fraud in the underlying case.
I'm sorry, no evidence?
There was some suggestion there was no contention contrary to fraud. There are issues about EMC's own conduct, what it did or didn't do, whether it was reasonable, whether the individual who made statements was even an agent of Ryerson's predecessor, whether that individual had authority to make the statements. All those kinds of things can go to negligence, omission, non-fraudulent type matters that would involve a breach of warranty, which certainly is not. A breach of warranty is not stealing and is not a fraud.
Let me ask you, is Ms. Bauer correct in describing the relief provided in the settlement as restitutionary?
No, it is not.
Why not? Because it looks as if restitution, you know, disgorgement of wrongfully acquired profit, why isn't that the core of restitution?
Because it assumes a settlement in this instance where you have non-fraud claims. In Level 3, the only basis for settlement could have been on a fraudulent taking, a stealing. In this case, there were non-fraudulent breach of warranty claims. Had Ryerson been able to prevail, Ryerson had rightful gain. It's not a disgorgement of rightful gain.
Yeah, but it returned $8.5 million. But wasn't that, whatever the basis, breach of contract, whatever, but wasn't that restitution? It was restoring money that it had received as profit in the sale?
EMC took the position that most plaintiffs do in the underlying case. It threw in the kitchen sink.
Everything that it paid, taxes, overhead charges. Hey, don't talk over me. That $8.5 million that it returned to EMC, wasn't that restoring a profit that it obtained from the sale to EMC?
It involved damages components. There were overhead charges that EMC was trying to say that it incurred. There's taxes that it incurred in a resale. That's not a return of a profit. You can have a gain. You can have a gain in all contracts you seek gain. If you have a dispute about what belongs on what side of the ledger.
To separate how much of the $8.5 million was restitution and how much was damages?
There isn't a specification, but the federal policy has a specific provision that addresses, so there is litigation over it, a specific provision that provides a percentage allocation in the event there are covered and uncovered claims. And that disposes of it by way of an express provision.
Have you argued that even if that $8.5 million is excessive because it includes damages?
I'm sorry?
Say there's some provision for allocating covered and uncovered losses. So has any allocation been attempted with respect to the $8.5 million?
It's provided for in the federal policy. If there are covered and uncovered.
No, has it been made? Has it been done?
No, it has not been. It has not been done.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.